I want to talk about, as I said, I want to talk about where we're going to go in the next part of the course, which is really, if you think about it, we're going to be looking at the psychology of religion. And the reason we're going to look at the psychology of religion rather than, say, the sociology of religion, which is an equally reasonable way to try and come to an understanding about religion, or the anthropology of religion, or religious literature, or something like that, is really articulated in this article by the Dalai Lama called Science at the Crossroads. Because what he's saying is that apart from the question of having dialogue between members of faiths to create a sense of pluralism, which is to say to create a world in which people have communication with each other and appreciate each other rather than blow each other up, I mean, to put it in the absolute simplest terms, okay, he's saying that the reason, he's saying that to get at the deepest level of understanding, it's very helpful to look at the basics of the human condition. If you go to any of the talks that he's been doing the last number of years all around the world, he goes over the same theme many, many, many times. Basically, he says things like, what is fundamental in human nature that we share as human beings, whether we're Asians, Westerners, Muslims, Christians, doesn't make any difference. What do we share? And on the basis of that commonality, we can then build our relationships with each other because we're common. We have something in common. If we didn't have something in common, we couldn't build relationships with each other. So what do we have in common? This becomes the basis for the understanding, which is the foundation of religious pluralism. I'm going to go another step. I'm going to go the step that Jung goes, which is to say, if we can find these things that are basic in human nature and human character, then not only do we have a foundation for understanding religiousness across cultures and understanding how we get along together in a globalized world, but we have a basis for understanding religiosity and understanding what is religion in human experience. Now, if you think about this, a couple thousand years ago, people didn't talk about religion. There's a certain way they didn't know what religion was. They just lived it, right? We have a way of separating out religion from other parts of our experience. In the West, traditionally what we do is we go to church on Sunday and we have a religious part of our life going on. The rest of the week, religion may not be part of our lives. So we have identified a certain time and space as the time and space in which we experience religion, and other times and space as non-religious. And that's a fundamental aspect to the way our society works. Muslims don't understand this at all. They think it's irreligious and nuts, because from their point of view, what we call religion is the way you live 24/7, 365. If you do anything else, there's something seriously wrong with the way you're living your life. It doesn't make any sense. Because what we call religion is something they consider to be a prescription for living the good life, as revealed by Muhammad, who shared the word of God with us about how we're supposed to live. Well, we have this experience of wanting to have a pluralistic society. I mean, that's sort of the definition of this society going back to the time of the revolution, essentially, or at least the Bill of Rights. So in order to have this pluralistic society, we have created essentially an artificial separation between religion and everything else. But now it's gotten to the point where we don't even know what religion is anymore, because we know what everything else is, but we don't know what religion is. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a class like this. This kind of a class would be completely crazy in the ancient world. What would it be? No, I mean, you know, people would reflect on what they did, but the idea that there's religion is apart from something else, that wouldn't make any sense at all. Maybe to a few Greeks, but on the whole, it wouldn't make sense to anybody else.
Okay.
So, we're going to look at what is it in human beings, finally, and the way human beings are as psychological beings that will move us forward with this project, and that's the reason for Jung. Now, Jung and all of his cohorts are psychotherapists. Their job is not really explaining religion. Their job is working with people who are dysfunctional in some way, and who are understood to be dysfunctional because there's a mental problem, a psychosocial problem. And Jung and his cohorts developed ways of working with these people that would improve their functioning in society. That's the simplest way to phrase it, or their internal sense of happiness. Okay. So the reason, though, this is discussed in the first chapter in the Jung book, and so the question is, why am I having you read this then? Because you can't understand Jung and his views about religion, which emerge out of his practice of psychotherapy, unless you understand what he was doing in his practice of psychotherapy. And to understand what he was doing in his practice of psychotherapy and how it is lodged in the larger history of psychotherapy or the larger history of psychology, I'm going to do a side trip into the history of psychology here, place Jung in it, and then place some of the other stuff we're going to read in that history also, so that we can get some, I hope, appreciation for the way in which thought about religious experience has evolved or developed in modern times. Okay, so that'll give you the picture of what we're trying to do here. Okay, so in the beginning, the beginning is the 19th century in this case. In the beginning, the early psychologists and psychiatrists saw themselves as scientists in the contemporary scientific model of how you did scientific research. And the origins of psychotherapy in the West really come out of a period of time where psychiatrists and medical doctors were looking at problems that were otherwise inexplicable, in particular the problem of hysterical paralysis. A doctor would see somebody who has a debilitating twitch, or a paralyzed arm, or is incapable of keeping a meal down, or whatever the case may be. And what is the problem? What is the source of the problem? This is a period of time when psychologists began to be interested in hypnosis, because they saw that hypnosis had some impact on symptoms. Excuse me. And et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to go into detail about this, but what arose out of this general stew of interest was a system of thought called psychoanalysis, which is identified with Sigmund Freud, the founder of psychoanalysis, who was a Viennese physician. And in the late 19th century, starting with his interest in hysterical paralysis, he developed some ideas about the nature of the mind, which are now foundational for everything we're going to talk about later, although we're going to go way past Freud. One idea that he developed was there was unconscious mental process. Okay, so until Freud really published this idea, nobody thought too seriously about the fact that they were conscious and they had a conscious element to their minds, and that they had part of their minds that they weren't aware of. That there was stuff going on within what we call the mind that they were not aware of. That was just like, what? How can that be? You know? It's like, I'm aware. Well, Freud pointed out that there were all kinds of processes going on that impacted the way people lived in the world, of which they were completely unaware. And he said the way you could become aware of these things was multiple, but the key way of becoming aware of these things was by looking at your dreams. That dreams were a way of getting a read of what was going on in the unconscious mind. So he was very interested in dreams. Because to look at dreams is to take material out of the unconscious mind, and by analyzing and thinking about dreams, you make that material conscious. So we're talking about increasing consciousness, and in this way, becoming conscious of problematic processes in the mind which are creating problems for us, whether they're hysterical blindness, or an inability to have a wholesome relationship with your spouse, or an inability to get along in the world because you're afraid to pick up a telephone and call somebody, or walk down the street because you're afraid of germs. I mean, there are all kinds of things that these people were dealing with. Now, these days, psychoanalysis is highly discredited as a psychotherapeutic system. But in the early 20th century, it had major traction. And in the 1920s and the 1930s in particular, it was extremely popular and successful in the United States. Successful in the sense that the psychiatrists and psychologists who are practicing this view of therapeutic work were successful in making money and having a social position. It's not clear how successful they were in curing people. That's another matter. But their thought influenced very broadly the culture. And that's more the key point. Because people began to be interested in this possibility that there's stuff going on within themselves, which wasn't physical, that was mental in a way, but which they were not conscious of. What could that possibly be? And why could that possibly be important? Okay. So that's the key thing about Freud and his ideas about psychoanalysis, this distinction between the conscious and the unconscious. Now, he believed there was a lot of stuff that was going on in the unconscious, or we might want to say the subconscious, that could be described in sort of generic categories. And his idea, a lot of behavior was motivated by eroticism, by sexuality, and by frustrated sexuality. Although he also began to think that there was another instinct at work in the subconscious mind that was equally powerful. He named these two instincts eros, or libido, for the instinct towards sexual fulfillment and creativity. But he said there was also what he called an instinct for destruction or death, which he called thanatos. So in Victorian Europe, the idea that motivation was powered by sex is pretty radical, and people pretty much rejected that in the beginning. But within a generation, that was more accepted. The idea that was never accepted, though, fully, broadly, in, from a cultural point of view, was the idea of thanatos, that we have an impulse toward destruction. Now, to me, living in the 21st century and looking back on the 20th century and everything going on in the 21st century, it seems abundantly clear that we have a powerful impulse toward destruction. It seems to be easier to find that than the impulse toward creativity in life, quite honestly. I mean, all you have to do is look around. What do we get for our taxes? We don't get a whole lot of love, but we sure get a lot of destruction, you know. I mean, if you think of reality as being associated with the gross domestic product in some way, not much of the gross domestic product goes into happiness, joy, and love. A large part of it goes into Hollywood, I guess, but more of it goes to the military establishment, which is not promoting love. We know that. You know, remember, make love, not war. We're making an awful lot of war, but not much love. Okay. So I think it's obvious that Freud was right about something there. Now, Freud had originally a student, then colleague, by the name of Carl Jung, who was not Viennese, he was Swiss. And if you're into cultural distinctions, this is a relevant distinction. But anyway, Jung began noticing that these kinds of impulses, like the thanatos, eros kinds of impulses, were actually not the only ones going on. He began to notice that there was much more going on in the unconscious than that. And he began to feel that there were impulses which he described with the term archetypal that reflected a whole diversity of different unconscious organizing principles and activities. When you begin reading about Jung, you'll see that he starts making some distinctions that are important. For example, he says what he calls the archetypes are not instincts. We do have instinctual behavior, but what he calls archetypes are forms that occur in our mind, organizing forms that occur in our subconscious mind that may be results of instincts, but are not only a result of instincts. One of the key points he makes, and you'll come across this in the readings that you'll be doing in his chapter in this book, which is the first chapter, is he says essentially, look, if you buy the theory of evolution, if you believe that Darwin and his successors are correct, then you see that the body evolved from earlier forms. And if you look very closely at the physical body, you see many elements in the body that don't seem to serve any contemporary purpose. And in fact, if you watch the body develop as a before birth, if you watch the body developing before birth, you see that the body goes through transformations over time that seem to resemble the evolutionary process. I think this is referred to as ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That's the technical word for it, correct? Is that right? Okay. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is to say that the growth of the individual body recapitulates the history of the evolution of human beings from the earliest time to the present. You start with a couple cells, you get something worm-like looking, tadpole looking, so on and so forth. Eventually you get something that's sort of like fetal looking, but maybe not human fetal looking, and finally you get something that looks sort of human. Yeah?
Is that why babies, before they seriously develop, have gills?
Yes. That would be an example. Gills, gill slits and tails in... you would get some interesting reactions walking around here if you still had gills, that's for sure.
I could put on like a scarf.
You put on a scarf. There you go.
Is there any animal that has gills and lungs?
Gee, I don't know. That would seem to be a problem, I would think.
Like if you couldn't...
They're different kinds of respiratory systems. I don't know. You know, tadpoles and frogs, do they start out with gills and then they somehow the respiratory system changes? That I don't know. It's beyond me. But here's the main point, okay? Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is the way this is described. But the point is, Jung asks this question, why would we think that that only happens for the body and not the mind? Why would we think that the human mind doesn't also go through a developmental process which is similar to the developmental process of the body in the sense that it follows a similar pattern from earlier stages to later? This becomes the cornerstone of Jungian analytic psychology, and it's explicitly worked through in the readings we'll be doing by the Jungian therapist Carl Whitmont. Not Carl Whitman, I'm sorry, but his last name is Whitmont, his first name isn't Carl. Anyhow, Whitmont explicitly works through this. I've forgotten his first name. Anyway, what would it mean if we had internal mental organs that were archaic and were functioning along with our more modern mental organs? Now, it's pretty clear that on the physiological level, when you're looking at the brainstem and all the physical features associated with the brainstem and the cortex, that there are elements, physiological elements, that we share with other animals that are more dominant in other animals, more recessive in us, but they're the same elements. I mean, you look at what the physiological psychologists have done with various subcortical brain structures, and you can see that. They've identified sources of pleasure, sources of aggression, and so on and so forth. And these things are similar across the animal kingdom. And they're operative in us, right? So if these functions are disabled in some way, or disturbed in some way, the associated emotional and cognitive functions are also affected. And they can watch how these things work now with very sophisticated electroencephalograph machines connected to computers, where they can actually get visual representations of the cortex, and they can watch the electromagnetic activity in the cortex, and the physiological activity in the cortex, and the chemical activity in the cortex. So when somebody's angry, a certain something, as it were, lights up in the brain. When people are thinking certain kinds of thoughts, other patterns exist in the brain. So this idea is not totally out in left field, although modern psychologists don't necessarily agree with Jung about the implications of it. But the fundamental idea, people will pretty much accept. Now, Jung makes the argument, though, and all the Jungians go forward with this argument, that if there are more archaic mental structures in the mind, which are not necessarily physical, so this is important, we're talking about archaic mental functions, which are not physical. And those are operating. Where are they operating? They're operating in the part of awareness or the mind or consciousness that Freud originally called the unconscious mind. So Jung's idea is that there are structures, there are mental structures that are operating which have an impact on conscious thought that we're not aware of and are archaic in character. They have to do with our evolution as a species. The way these things manifest is through symbols. They manifest through emotions. They manifest through fascinations. They manifest through a certain kind of energy and enthusiasm and interest. In order to identify them, he called them archetypes. And this is the meaning of archetypes. Now, in the readings, you're going to get a much better, more specific kind of definition of archetype. But it's important to remember that the archetype is not the underlying thing. It's the organizing quality of that underlying thing when we come to know it, is the way I would describe it. It's a little bit of a dangerous word, because if you know anything about Western philosophy, you know that the Greeks talked about archetypes. And an archetype for Plato was a divine form, and then everything manifest as an expression of that divine form, right? So there's a divine form for tables, and all tables are expressions of that divine form. So this word archetype is a little bit problematic if you think about things that way. As it turns out, hardly anybody knows anything about Greek philosophy, so it's not really an issue, but it could be. Okay. Dreams, for Jung, are an expression of those archetypal forms. But so are the symbols of religion, and so are myths. And that's why this stuff gets interesting, for the purpose of this class anyway. Because what Jung discovered in working with the symbolic productions of the unconscious minds of his patients, he discovered the emergence of symbolism, which he could find in religions all over the world, even though his patients didn't know about those religions. He found, for example, alchemy, which was essentially an old Western religion. He found that his patients were producing alchemical symbols in their dreams in sequences over time, which replicated alchemical processes that people had talked about 500 years before, and his patients didn't know anything about alchemy. So where did this stuff come from? Or his patients would be producing dreams that had images that had certain shapes that he could see in paintings from India, called mandalas, for example. And his patients had never seen a mandala. They didn't know what one was. And yet they were producing dreams and dramas that replicated those things. His argument, his conclusion, was all human beings have these underlying structures that produce these symbolic processes, these underlying mental structures that they're not aware of, that produce these symbolic processes that we recognize as religious experience and as religious forms. Therefore, from his point of view, a lot of what we call religion is a natural expression of the human mental condition. So now we loop back to why we're dealing with Jung in this class, because we're asking the question, where does religion come from? Jung is saying it comes out of our minds naturally, essentially. Okay. So we're going to explore this in great detail, especially the stuff about mythology, because mythology is clearly a religious expression. There's no question about that in anybody's minds. Now, this way of looking at things only got so much traction in the Western scientific world. A lot of it is not amenable to science. It's anecdotal. It's based on literature. It's based upon what's going on in the subconscious mind of patients, and so on and so forth. So the Western tradition of scientific psychology took another line. And it took a line into, in the West, what was called behaviorism, which was then called second force psychology. And the reason it was called second force psychology was psychoanalysis was the first force. Behaviorism was the second force. Behaviorism was kind of an attempt to be very systematic and scientific in the description of the way humans behave, because the mind couldn't be studied scientifically, they thought. so we can only study its expression in the form of behavior, therefore behaviorism. And we can do experiments with humans, with people, but also with non-people, like mice, rats, pigeons, etc., etc., on the assumption that there are similarities in behavior across the animal kingdom, from humans to pigeons. And that's kind of interesting, because in a hidden way, it's essentially saying the same thing as Freud and Jung, that their underlying structures were the same in all beings. But we're not going to go down that line. Okay. In the 1960s, a lot of people, especially psychotherapists, started getting really fed up with behaviorism, but also recognized that there were significant limitations in the psychoanalytic approach to things. Behaviorism didn't really speak very much about some of the most important human experiences, like love. Like, do pigeons love? Well, B.F. Skinner never worried about that particular problem, right? But that matters to most people. How about nuclear annihilation? Maybe we want to study how come we don't get along together and aggression and things like that. That was not a Skinnerian issue, as far as I'm aware of, anyway. So, the problem that many psychotherapists in particular had with psychoanalysis, though, was it was basically pessimistic in view. The basic view in psychoanalysis is that you have these impulses, but a lot of them are antisocial, you know, like Thanatos is antisocial, or even Eros. It's like, you know, we're big on monogamy in this society, but Eros might suggest multiple erotic partners. Well, we can't go there, right? So the Freud, I'm overly grossly simplifying here, but so the psychoanalytic point of view was sort of like the best we can do is maintain some degree of order with our own mental process and adjust ourselves to the expectations and requirements of society. And in the end, we're going to be frustrated because I may not want one wife, but that's all I'm going to get. Or I really might want to kick the ass of the guy down the street with the loud dogs, but if I do that, I'm going to get into serious trouble, so I won't. And I'll have to just put up with the loud dogs and put up with the obnoxious neighbor. That's adjustment. That's life. That's the best you can get. A lot of people thought, that's not good enough. There's got to be more to it than that. And in the 60s and 70s, what evolved was what was called a third force psychology. It was associated with what's often now and then called the human potential movement, which is, don't human beings have more going on to them, potentially, than just that? This is the time when, in a really big way, psychologists started looking at Asian systems of thought. Because Asian systems of thought propose that deep within ourselves is this divine element. Now remember, in the Judeo-Christian system, God's up there and we're down here. So if you look inside of yourself, you might find a soul, but you don't find God. And if you're sort of psychoanalytically oriented, you look inside yourself, you find a frustrated set of impulses, but you surely don't find God, okay? People said, well, maybe there really is more going on than that. And what do we find if we look inside? Could we find impulses toward higher functioning? Could we find impulses of a higher character, you know? Could we find impulses toward altruism, toward creativity, toward collective love, toward whatever? So the human potential movement was about what is human potential? Because people didn't know. What is potential for human beings? We've been busy looking at the limitations imposed on human beings, but what was potential for human beings? So that was where a lot of thought came into looking at Asian religion, looking at arts in relationship to human beings as being important, looking at personal expression as being important in certain ways. And it's not accidental that this is all post-McCarthyism, and there are all kinds of cultural elements that are connected with it that are quite relevant, but we're not going to go into that stuff in this class. Third force psychology, that's what it became known as. Humanistic psychology grew out of that. Transpersonal psychology grew out of that. And those things still exist in the American Psychological Association. There are divisions for these things. Finally, what emerged, and this is where I'm going to wrap this story up, was advanced forms of physiological psychology and cognitive psychology. Because new forms of experimentation became possible as the technology and as chemical research permitted and as genetic research permitted. So, I mean, now you can do things that you couldn't do in the 1960s and 70s, such as instead of putting two electrodes on somebody's brain and trying to figure out what's going on inside, you can put 100 electrodes on their brain and hook them up to a computer and get a three-dimensional rendering of what's happening. Well, in 1965, you couldn't do that. So it's utterly changed psychology. So I guess we have four forces in psychology. As it turns out, most of the people who are interested in cognitive psychology have less or no religion, no interest at all in religion. So if we go back, though, we look at what's in the what was going on in the human potential movement, and among the psychoanalysts, such as Jung, they had a lot to say about religion as an expression of human life and commonalities and differences. And where do a lot of these things come from? You know, how is it the case that we can have Jesus crucified on a cross, but we can also have Norse gods who are crucified on trees? And we can have Buddha getting enlightened under a tree. Is there some similarity? I mean, what is this thing with tree symbolism? You know, they start looking at these sorts of things. So that's the direction we're going to be going, sort of from here on out. Okay?